Hey, it's Noel. This is the last episode of Season 2 of Lost Highways, and we're hoping you can help us with a quick favor. Whether you're a regular listener or new to the podcast, we'd be much obliged if you'd take a minute to fill out our end-of-season survey. Just go to historycolorado.org/podcast survey. It'll only take a few minutes, and you can help us make next season better. Thank you so much.
Lost Highways from History Colorado is made possible by the Sturm Family Foundation, proud supporters of the humanities and the power of storytelling for more than 20 years.
And by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
My full name is Juan Federico Miguel Arroyo Trujillo. When I started school, I was 5 years old. I went to the Holy Trinity School in Trinidad. It was a Catholic school, a parochial school, I think is what they call them. Never spoke English, and so when I went into school, the teacher asked me what my name was, and I said, Juan Federico Trujillo. And she says, no, it's John Fred Trujillo. Told her, no, it's Juan Federico Trujillo. And she slapped me. And she says, once you learn your place, you'll be all right. And you look like a Freddy. And, you know, it bothered me because I didn't understand what was going on. I went to school, and they would beat us because we weren't speaking English. The nuns were very, very nasty with me. They would always use these rulers to slap you with on the hands or wherever they wanted to. Then they would tell you, God hates you because you speak Spanish. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? Who am I going to pray to? I mean, I've been praying to Dios for these 6-7 years. Now I got it. He don't like me. What am I going to do? Finally, in the third grade, after taking all these beatings, one day I just said to myself, mira, p***o, if you don't learn to speak English, they're going to kill you, man. They'll kill you right here. And they had the rights to do that because corporal punishment was nothing. They came short of killing us. And then they'd always throw that thing about God hates you. Well, finally, I started to learn to speak English.
From History Colorado Studios, this is Lost Highways, dispatches from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. I'm Tyler Hill.
And I'm Noel Black.
On this episode, the life and times of Juan Federico Arguello Trujillo, also known by his nickname, Freddy Freak.
Freddy was an activist in El Movimiento, the Chicano movement in Colorado. He was also a keeper of stories, history, and lore, and had an uncanny knack for being where history was being made.
El Movimiento sought to establish Chicano power, identity, and pride through greater access to education, reclaimed cultural awareness, and self-determined political power in communities throughout Colorado and the United States.
Freddy Freak's own cultural awakening and discovery of his Chicano identity follows the contours of both the internal and external struggles and triumphs of El Movimiento.
Freddy's oral history, which you'll hear throughout the episode, was recorded at History Colorado's El Pueblo Museum in Pueblo by our colleague Jose Ortega, a close friend of Freddy's. You can listen to an extended version of these interviews at one of History Colorado's other podcasts, Co-Authored, which you can find on iTunes and Google Play.
This episode is dedicated to the memory of Chicana activist Rita Martinez, a longtime Pueblo resident and member of History Colorado's El Movimiento Advisory Committee. She died of complications from COVID-19 this past December.
Here's Freddy.
I was born in Trinidad, Colorado, in 1938, October the 15th. It was just before World War II started. My father died, was hit and run on the old highway from Trinidad to Starkeville. Starkeville is a little town south of Trinidad, about 5 miles. That's where my mother was born. And my father was on the way home up to Starkeville when he was hit by a car and killed. So I never met my dad. My mother, she had been, as a child, she had had an operation on her tonsils, and somehow there was a botched operation which left her deaf. She couldn't hear. My mother spoke very little English. She understood it more than she spoke. She spoke Spanish, well, we all did.
To understand Freddie's story and the story of El Movimiento, it's important to know that Trinidad and Starkville, located in what is now southern Colorado, were both part of Mexico before 1848.
My name is Liz Escovedo, and I am an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Denver, and my specialization is in Mexican-American history, especially in the 20th century. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo brings an official end to the Mexican-American War that took place between 1846 to 1848. And this is a treaty that really formally ends the war, but also establishes the boundaries of the United States that we all live with today, right? So we are all still living with this treaty.
When those lands were ceded, the United States formally gained 1 million square miles of land that are now Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Utah, parts of Wyoming, Kansas, and Oklahoma, and parts of southern and western Colorado.
The treaty is important for a number of reasons, because when we look at the Chicano movement of the 1960s and 1970s, you see a number of leaders coming to the forefront and expressing the fact that many of the issues that are facing the Mexican-American community in the United States harken back to this treaty and the land dispossession that took place.
In an effort to make the war look less like a conquest, the United States paid $15 million to Mexico. They also ensured in Articles 8 and 9 that any Mexican citizens who chose to remain in what was now U.S. territory would enjoy full property rights and the rights of citizenship.
But as with many treaties that the United States negotiated with Native and Indigenous populations,
these rights were not especially respected, because what we begin to see is a tremendous number of Anglos migrating into these territories in tremendous numbers. Into places like California, for instance. And with these population shifts, we begin to see tremendous land loss, loss of political power, violence, and a lot of cultural and personal upheaval.
Whether they were driven by the discovery of gold or fertile farmlands, Anglos chasing manifest destiny would often squat or lay claim to Mexican-American lands.
And so whenever and wherever Anglo-Americans dominated numerically and economically, Mexicans lost their political base and therefore their electoral representation.
And not surprisingly, poverty often followed the Mexican-Americans who'd been, quote, crossed by the border.
Freddie's family was no different, and he began selling papers and shining shoes from the time he started school.
I was always working. I wasn't one of your little babosos that's out committing crimes and all that, right? I was out hustling, trying to make money, trying to figure out a way to help my mom.
But when he didn't come home with money, Freddie's mom would verbally and physically abuse him.
My mother used to always tell me, she said, you know, you're the spin image of your father, you look just like him. And he was a drunk. And you're going to be a drunk. And you're going to die a drunk. But when she wasn't happy, she would beat me. She broke broomsticks, mop sticks over my head, my back. She tried to hang me one time with a diaper. My auntie, probably son, my cousin, Lisa, I caught her. Saved me, or I'd be dead.
So Freddie worked even harder.
I would go out and buy two papers, go out and sell them, bring the money back and buy 3 or 4 more papers and go sell them and kept doing that. By the end of the day, I'd maybe own, made a dime. But I'd go home with 10 cents. And my mother would be happier than hell. That's when I figured out my little pea brain. You know? That's when my mom likes money. If I can make money, the beatings will stop. Finally, I guess I must have been about 11 years old. She wanted to beat me and I jumped up. And I told her, if you ever touch me again, I'll kill you. I don't want no more beatings. And the beatings stopped. The beatings stopped.
Around the end of World War II, Freddie and his mom moved to Denver, where they lived on the largely Mexican-American West Side.
Freddie continued to work and go to school, but aside from math, which helped him with work, school seemed less and less relevant to Freddie. The public school system at that time wasn't invested in the education of non-white kids for anything outside vocational roles.
Freddie knew he'd be working the same kinds of jobs whether he had a high school diploma or not, and college didn't seem like an option for most Mexican-Americans at the time.
At the age of 16, I told my mother, I said, look, today's my birthday, man. I'm 16 years old today. I said, I'm old enough to quit school legally. And I can go to work full-time. I said, I could be a busboy. I could wash dishes, you know, whatever it is. So she said, okay. So I went up to West High School. When I walked in there, and I gave them my note saying that I had the right to quit school because I was of legal age. My mom said it would be okay. So they said, okay, goodbye. So I walked out and I stood in front of West High School and I said, West High. And I walked away from there. West High was the 13th school that I had went to in 11 years of my life.
By the time he was 20 in the mid-1950s, Freddie was married and had kids.
I married Mary Lucy Rita Agnes Bustos. She lived in the projects. And we got married and we had a son. Like they say, the first one comes anytime. The next one takes 9 months. So we had a baby soon. We named him John Fred. A little later, we had another son, Gerald Anthony. And I had a daughter named Annette Elaine.
Then, like his father before him, Freddie started drinking.
Well, my wife and I were boozers. We'd go dancing and we'd get drunk and I didn't realize till later on in life that I was getting involved in something that was way beyond my comprehension. But what ends up happening is, like I said, I ended up Skid Row Avenue, man. Sleeping in a cardboard box in an alley, man. Like one of them street people, man. I see these people today and I see them the way they look and I flash on myself because that's what I looked. Dirty and ugly, stinky.
Freddie managed to get himself off the street and got a job at a factory making hypodermic needles, but he kept drinking.
When his boss noticed him drunk at work a few times, he took Freddie to Alcoholics Anonymous and eventually helped him get into rehab.
But while he was in rehab for alcohol addiction, he got addicted to drugs.
I got hit one time by a club by a cop. I'm beat up in my back and all this. I have a lot of pain, so they put me on pain pills. I couldn't sleep, so they put me on sleeping pills. I was a nervous wreck, so they gave me tranquilizers. So took away the yaya and everything, you know. So, while later, this friend asked me if I'd ever heard of barbiturate addiction, barbiturates. And I said, no. I said, what are they? She said, you know those little pills that you take, those tranquilizers, sleeping pills, those muscle relaxers, pain pills, all that. Those are all barbiturates. I'm going to be the first to tell you. So you're a junkie, man. You're a junkie for barbiturates. Oh, God, now I got to join N.A. Well, thank God they were just across the hall from each other because I could go from A.A. to N.A. and back and forth. Well, I was in the hospital. I was in there for 18 weeks. I had never had psychiatric treatment in that. And while I was there, I started to find out about why these things were happening. And I asked one of my aunties, one of my cousins, about why my mother was so mean. And she says, well, she says, you got to understand that Uncle Siquel, that was my uncle, that was my mother's brother. He used to beat him. The sisters, he had three sisters. My mother had two sisters, so my uncle Siquel was always beating them up. From that, I believe she got to where she hated men. Anyway, that's what one of my cousins said. She hated men because of that. Then it started making sense. It's like a puzzle, a big puzzle, and they're putting the little pieces back in there. And now it's starting to make sense why she was this way. So I ended up getting out of the hospital. The first thing I did is I went home to my mother's house. I hugged her. I told her I forgave her for all of the things that she had done to me. We hugged, we cried. We kissed and we made up. And for 7.5 years of my life, not only was she my mother, but she was my friend. Something I had never had.
After that, he went to see his wife and kids.
I came home, and I remember it was a real hot day, man. I came home, and the kids, Daddy, Daddy, they're all around me. Lucy was ironing, and she said, hi, honey. And I said, hi, honey, how you doing? She said, fine. She says, why don't you get us a couple of Coors out of the refrigerator? I said, Lucy, I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic, man. One drink's too many, and a million's not enough, man. And I'll die if I have another drink. Oh, that's bull****. You know, come on. I told my kids, I love you, but I can't stay here.
After Freddie and Lucy got divorced, he got a job as a printer in Boulder, but he struggled not to drink while he was alone in Denver on the weekends.
When a friend at work offered to let him live with her and her husband in the mountains outside Boulder, he took her up on it.
Now that he was sober, Freddie started seeing the world differently, and he noticed how some of his white coworkers treated him differently.
I didn't realize this till later what was going on, but they would refer to me as Pancho and Pedro and Pablo and all kinds of good stuff. And there was two Chicana women. In those days, we used to call ourselves Spanish American. They were working over in this particular part of the building. And they'd always refer to them as hot tamales or hot tomatoes, hot peppers and that. One day I got pissed off and I gathered them all around. And I said, you know, you call me all these names. I said, you know my name is Fred. I said, you know, I know you guys have been reading in the Denver Post this Rudolfo Corky Gonzalez. Runs an organization down there in Denver at 1530 Downing Street. How would you like it if I brought Corky over here and about 300 or 400 Chicanos? And have them stick their finger in your face and call you a redneck pecker with son of a bitch. Because that's what you are, all of you. Bunch of crackers.
If you want to know more about the Chicano movement, come explore our El Movimiento exhibition at the History Colorado Center in downtown Denver at 1200 North Broadway, just a half block from the Denver Art Museum. Created in collaboration with community advisors from across the state, The El Movimiento exhibit uses artifacts, photos, video footage, and interviews to share the story of the Chicano struggle for civil rights in Colorado. History Colorado, creating a better future for Colorado by inspiring wonder in our past.
Born 10 years before Freddie in 1928, Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez was a professional boxer who'd grown up on Denver's east side. He was active in Democratic Party politics and voter registration efforts in his community throughout his young adult life.
In 1959, Gonzalez became the chairman of the Denver Viva Kennedy Committee that supported John F. Kennedy's run for president. But the experience left him disillusioned. Here's journalist and activist Juan Espinoza.
And then after Kennedy won and he was disappointed that we didn't get anything for our support. The political machine moved on without us, didn't even thank us for helping with the Kennedy campaign.
Then, in 1966, Corky founded an organization in Denver called the Crusade for Justice. It was dedicated to Chicano liberation and power. Here's Elizabeth Escobedo.
And the idea here that I think appeals to a lot of Chicanos and Chicanas at the time is that the Crusade for Justice emphasizes seizing control, right? Providing power for the Mexican American community. So it's calling for political action, and then it's also really emphasizing the importance of racial pride.
The Crusade for Justice was founded in Denver at roughly the same time that Cesar Chavez was organizing agricultural laborers and boycotts in California under the banner of the United Farm Workers.
Cesar Chavez, a disciple of Gandhi, leads the strike.
How long have you stabbed on your fellow workers?
But where Chavez was more interested in big tent union politics and coalition building, Corky Gonzalez advocated for Chicano cultural nationalism and self-determination. For activists like Corky, choosing to identify as Chicano was to reclaim one's cultural identity and reject assimilation into white America.
Longtime activist Ricardo Lafore, a member of History Colorado's El Movimiento Advisory Committee, says the word Chicano derives from the Aztec word mexica.
M-E-X-I-C-A. So a Mexicano was a Mexica. And my understanding is that it's people just simply dropped the me and it became Chicano. But I remember even as a child that the word was not widely used, and it was considered somewhat of a pejorative because people would use Pachuco and Chicano in the same breath.
Lafore says that for Mexican Americans, choosing to call themselves Chicano also put an end to all the hand-wringing over what others would call them.
Prior to Chicano, we were called so many, many things. Spanish American, Latin American, Hispanic, and all of these seemed to me like that the Census Bureau, every time they wanted to change our name, they just added a new category, and we fell in line with that. And there are some people who claim to be Spanish because it's more, you know, European or more continental, easier to assimilate into a white society. But I never really liked those names because those were names that were given to us, given by someone else. And the word Chicano really became a rallying cry in it. And I love the word Chicano because it was something of our own choosing. This is what we call ourselves.
Corky Gonzalez also helped define Chicano struggles and identity with the epic poem Yo Soy Joaquin, which was published in 1967. For many young Chicanos, it gave voice to the conflicts of living in a country that they believed had colonized their land and stolen their culture.
I am Joaquin. Lost in a world of confusion, caught up in a whirl of a gringo society, confused by the rules, scorned by attitudes, suppressed by manipulations, and destroyed by modern society. My fathers have lost the economic battle and won the struggle of cultural survival. And now I must choose between the paradox of victory of the spirit.
Elizabeth Escobedo says that Corky Gonzalez's vision became a political movement right as the 1960s were coming to a close. It was a time when the anti-war movement, along with the Black Panther Party and the American Indian movement, were taking a less conciliatory, more militant approach to their activism.
And we see this all coming together when you have, in March of 1969, a national Chicano Liberation Youth Conference that is put together. You have more than 1,500 young people attending from across the nation. And the most enduring concept to come out of that meeting was this document, El Plan de Aztlan.
Aztlan is the name of the mythical home of the Aztecs. A Chicano poet who went by the name Alurista gave the name to the area of the Southwest that was ceded to the United States in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
El Plan Espiritual de Aztlan was a blueprint for Chicano identity that drew from that past before the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and pointed toward a future of their own making.
The Plan de Aztlan was written first, the spiritual part was written by poets, was written by beautiful people of compassion, written by young men who recognize that liberation comes only when people are brave enough to stand up and call themselves a man or a woman. And El Plan, after we got through with...
Within the document, we see calls for separate Chicano institutions, for Chicano-run schools, even a separate political party based on this idea of self-determination and nationalism, that Mexican Americans should take control of their self-defense of their community because police were engaging in widespread brutality against them rather than protecting.
The plan was nationalist, and it called for the formation of a new political party.
Corky very much believed that the Democrats and Republicans, as he said, were feeding from the same trough, right? And that only through independent action, getting away from that two-party system, could we actually be able to engage in real political change.
And, Escobedo says, the plan called for cultural nationalism, a reclamation of identity as a means to self-determination.
That cultural values should be the moral background of the movement, right? That our youth should grow up learning about their history through art and literature and dance and exposures to Chicano and Chicana writers.
Ricardo Laferre says that unlike Cesar Chavez, who followed the nonviolent principles of Gandhi, Corky simply didn't believe that white people would have the best interests of Chicanos at heart.
In a way, I guess you could say they were kind of like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
And like Malcolm X, Corky wasn't afraid of direct confrontation or violence.
Your own identity, you don't know who you are. You have no value, you have no worth. And that's why it's very important. It's very important that we speak in the colleges. Isn't it rather odd that most of the cats you've been calling to rap at all the college symposiums are not college people?
However empty the threat might have been, when Freddie confronted his coworkers for their racism and threatened to bring Corky and a few Chicanos up to Boulder to settle the matter, he was awakening to the anger that many in the Chicano movement felt at the time.
Now 30 years old, Freddie hadn't yet joined the movement, but he sensed there was something better for him than the endless work and struggles he'd lived with his whole life.
So anyway, I took off the money that I got from my last check. I went and bought me a Kelty pack. I bought me a brand new pair of hiking boots. And I hitchhiked out to San Francisco. First time I'd ever done anything like that. Got out there and fell in love with the hippies. When I got back to Boulder, there was this guy come up to me. His name was Skirt. Come up to me one day and he said, we're going to have a love-in this weekend, man, and I need some help. And he says, what the hell's a loving and what, you know, and he said, well, this is, you know, what it's all about. They said, we're going to bring these musicians in and we're going to play music and it's going to be love, peace, and beads. And I said, ooh, that sounds cool. So anyway, I started working with this guy.
Boulder was almost as overrun with hippies as San Francisco was in the late 60s and early 70s.
Freddie and his new friends started setting up concerts in the Bandshell in Central Park on Broadway in Boulder. They'd panhandle money and rent a generator for the day. Then bands would seem to show up out of nowhere. The Grateful Dead showed up once, and Freddie became an instant fan.
Another rock group named Zephyr were regulars at the Bandshell.
A volcano of dreams, a life slowly fading, has erupted and flowed after night.
They were a local Denver group. I met them at a place called the Family Dog. It was out on Evans, out there in West Denver, right off of Federal Boulevard. And it was a place where all these hippies would go hang out, right? I didn't know all these bands were going there, right? So I'd go there, and I had short hair. I always wore a top coat, cardigan sweaters. I was styling, man, horn-rimmed glasses. I'd look like a narc. I'd go to these places, and I'd watch all of these hippies having a good time. I'd say, whoa, this is cool stuff, man. So it just happened that I was at the Family Dog, and I met this group, and they told me, they said, you know, looks like you're on the fringe, ready to freak out, man. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, you see them people now? You're going to be one of those. I said, oh, whoa. Well, anyway, what ends up happening, I did. I freaked out. From that moment on, any time Zephyr was playing anywhere, I could just go there, and if there was an entrance fee, I could always tell them that I was part of the band, and they would come out there and let me in.
Not only did Freddie freak out when Zephyr played, there was also an underground comic illustrated by an artist named Gilbert Shelton called the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers that got passed around among hippies at the time. Here's Juan Espinoza.
And I think one of them might have been named Freddie. I'm not positive of that. But anyway, he looked like one of the cartoon characters with his big fro. He had an afro. He wore his, he had curly hair and he teased it out. And that was one of his trademarks.
The nickname found its way to Freddie, and it stuck, especially as he started hanging out with the hippies on campus where he could often be seen playing Frisbee. Here's his friend and fellow activist, Deborah Espinoza.
I don't remember the first time I met Freddie, but I remember the first time I saw him. Of course, it was about the same time Juan is talking about. We were newlyweds. We were married in June and then on campus that fall. But I remember seeing Freddie playing Frisbee right outside of the UMC, the student center, and he was just wearing cutoffs. That's it. No shirt, no sandals, nothing. That was Freddie.
I was known at that time as Freddie Freak, the hippie. In 1968, I also was a Frisbee freak. I used to play Frisbee. He used to call me also call me Freddie Frisbee. But one day I was up on campus, it was like in the spring of 68. I walked on campus and I heard this Chicano power, Viva La Raza, and I started listening to him. And I asked this other freak that was, who are these guys? Who are they? And he says, they're called Umas and they're a bunch of communists. I said, ooh, shit. This is scary stuff, like the Llorona, man, you know.
UMAS was the United Mexican American Students. It was one of several Chicano student organizations on the University of Colorado campus at the time.
There was also Mecha, or the Chicano student movement of Aslan.
These groups still exist at many college campuses across the country. They work to make sure that college and university administrations prioritize the educational, social, political, and cultural needs of Chicano students.
For example, they fought to have Chicano studies taught across the country. Here's Professor Nikki Gonzalez of Regis University. She's also a member of the Colorado State Historians Council.
And this brand of activism really emerged as a result on the Boulder campus in response to a lack of representation in the administration at CU Boulder and a lack of financial aid policies and programs that enabled young Chicanos to attend college in Boulder. And so in the spirit of the time, and this is, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, these students took it upon themselves to protest, to occupy buildings on campus, and to try to force the administration to meet their needs and to recognize their contributions to the communities.
UMAS was also there to make sure that Chicano students who got an education could stay connected with the communities they grew up in, so they could share the knowledge and training they gained in college. This was a big part of Corky Gonzalez's vision, as outlined in the Plan Espiritual de Aslan.
And we want to create, out of the young people, an understanding of who you are and where you owe your leadership to, your ideas, your bodies, your brains, and your professions, and that you have to take them back home. And the college student has been isolating himself from the barrio. In California, I see one of the most advanced student movements of college Chicanos in all of the United States in the Southwest. I see the most advanced movement, and I see the most depressing movement within the community. And there must be some reason that there is not a communication. There is not an involvement.
So anyway, I kept listening to these guys, and one thing that got me was that they were speaking Spanglish, Spanish and English, and I thought, wow, how did they get away with that? You know, I got beat up for talking that way. But I kept listening to them. Well, anyway, and they were talking about the problems they were having with admissions and all this stuff, right? So anyway, the last thing he said is, this Saturday we're going to have an UMAS dance in the UMC ballroom.
Almost always broke, Freddie often snuck into concerts and events. And for the UMAS dance, he slipped in through a window he'd opened earlier that day.
Anyway, so when I snuck in there, and when I heard about UMAS being a communist, I expected to see a picture of Joseph Stalin up there, or hammers, sickle, and all of that, right? But not that, you know. And I said, wow, check this out, man. These people are dancing mambos, cha-chas, corridos, polkas.
Energized by the connection with his childhood culture, Freddie woke up early the next morning.
I have this little hill there where I would go out there and I would sit there in a lotus position. Clear my mind and all that. And say, God, remember when I told you that I would never become a communist? I said, we got an issue here, man. I met these people. They have Mexican food, tamales, enchiladas, and they dance polkas and mambos and cha-chas and corridos. I want to be a part of that, man. So I know I promised you I would never join the Communist Party, but I'm sorry, but I have to. So I joined. UMAS and MAP were not a Communist Party, but that's, you know, that was the lie that we were told.
Though some students certainly had Marxist or socialist sympathies, allegations that groups like UMAS were communist often came from outsiders trying to discredit them.
Not long after joining UMAS, Freddie enrolled in a summer-long course in Chicano studies at CU Boulder, and the classes were a revelation to him.
One of my teachers' name was Abelardo Lalo Delgado. He got up and he started to read his speech, Stupid America. When Lalo started talking about stupid America, I started to cry. I said, how can a man like that talk about a country that I love so much and he calls us stupid? Anyway,
I listened, and then his name started coming up. A simulation. Acculturation. The Americanization process. They change your names. They change your language. They want you to assimilate. Now I know what that first grade teacher told me. You got to assimilate, you got to acculturate. It took me 22 years later to find out what she meant. But now I know. Now I know who I am. And from that moment on, I become Chicanoized. When I finished my summer program, Felipe come up to me and he says, "What did you say your name was?" Tom, tú quieres saber mi nombre, pues mi nombre es Juan Federico Miguel Arroyo Trujillo. Soy Azteca, mestizo, Tehuachicano, and this American dream was a pinche nightmare for me. It was a lie. That American dream and that whole thing about the fathers of my country, Abraham Lincoln and all that, them p***s were nobody. They were not my people were Francisco Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata. These were my people, not these other ones. And I sit there and I took Chicano studies and all of a sudden, I felt so overwhelmed because all of a sudden, I'm proud to be a Chicano. I'm not a Spanish American anymore. I am a Chicano and I am proud of what I am. Till the day I die, I'll carry my message to all about who we are as Chicano people, what we want, what we expect. All we wanted in those days was a fair education. All we wanted was to go to college. All we wanted is to go to a university. We just wanted a chance. We finally got it.
To learn more about the stories you hear on Lost Highways, check out History Colorado's 8 museums around the state, like the El Pueblo History Museum in Pueblo, which features a series of exhibits, events, and more related to the borderlands of southern Colorado. From a place of meeting between indigenous tribes to a physical border between nations, from the boundary between mountains and plains to everyday convergences of cultural and ethnic borders, this exhibit illuminates the site's specific geopolitical border history, as well as the region's historic and ongoing borders of cultures, ethnicities, landscapes, industries, religions, and identities.
Freddie himself was never sure if he'd make it to college. At this point, he was already in his 30s, and soon after he got involved with UMass, his ex-wife got sick and asked if he could take the kids.
But Freddie's friends encouraged him to enroll as a full-time student at CU Boulder, which meant he'd get food stamps and affordable family housing.
His friend Deborah Espinoza says that having his kids with him didn't slow him down. And he soon found himself on the front lines of UMass protests and demonstrations.
A lot of these kids that went into college on a big campus never thought they were going to college. These opportunities opened up because of the civil rights movement. And universities were catching up, vigorously trying to catch up when the public realized that about 1% of the 20,000 students, were people of color. And then a lot of us got involved in the politics of UMass because there was a lot to do.
The protests and activities of UMass and Mecha were incredibly effective. Chicano enrollment at CU Boulder and other universities in the Southwest grew exponentially from the mid-1960s into the 1970s.
But the rapid rise of the Chicano movement on the CU Boulder campus was seen by some as a serious threat. Beyond the campus administration, the Boulder police and the FBI had taken notice.
At the beginning of May 1974, UMass occupied the administrative building TB1 on the CU campus to protest a shortage of financial aid for Chicano students. Here's Juan Espinoza.
The university basically tried to wait us out. They ignored us. We were in those... in that occupation for almost 3 weeks.
Then, on May 27th, a car bomb exploded near Chautauqua Park, killing UMass student activists Una Jacola, Neva Romero, and Reyes Martinez.
Well, that just freaked the hell out of us all because we were scared. We didn't know what was going on. We knew that there was a lot of, like, Nazis, right-wingers, birchers, Coors supporters, that Republican element there. So we didn't know who could have been responsible for that. The following day, we were there. Freddy Granados comes up there and he says, "Man, we got to get it on. You know, these people, look what they've done, man. You know, we just can't." And I don't know. We didn't know what to do. You know, we were hoping that the administration would come, but nothing.
2 days later, another car bomb went off, killing three more UMAS activists, Florencio Granado, Heriberto Turan, and Francisco Doherty.
Here's Deborah Espinoza.
I remember Freddie being a part of that, being with us. I remember talking quietly with him after the bombings and sharing our feelings and how shocked we were and how awful and sad it was that we had to wait for dental reports to find out if indeed our friends had been killed.
Shortly after that, the university came and negotiated with us. I don't even know what they negotiated. You know, I don't even know. We were dying of a broken heart and scared to death because we didn't know, you know.
The six students who were killed in the two car bombings became known as Los Seis. Though many within UMass suspected the FBI was involved, to this day, no one has been charged for their deaths.
After the bombings, everyone in UMass was on edge.
We used to joke about it later. "Hey, do me a favor, go out and start my car." You know? Because people were afraid to even start their own cars.
But despite their fears, the attacks only served to focus the Chicano students' sense of purpose and mission in the broader fight for recognition.
Freddie soon got even more involved in the movement, this time in the ongoing boycott against Coors beer.
Joe Coors went down to the Golden Brewery. There he found a surprise. 1,000 brewery workers on a long picket line. Joe Coors could not believe his eyes. No, Joe Coors could not believe his eyes. He said
the Coors boycott came about when people began to realize that the Coors family had a long history of discrimination against, particularly in Colorado, the Hispanic population. And in 1966, when the crusade for justice under the leadership of Corky Gonzalez really seized upon this issue and called out Coors and this history of discrimination against Mexican-Americans, against women, against African-Americans, and called for the community to boycott that beer. And the boycott lasted from about 1966 until the early 70s, but some people would say it lasts even until today. There are still people in the Chicano community, a Mexican-American community, who still make a statement and do not drink Coors beer.
Come all you fellow strikers, so brave and so fine, and seek out a place on the long picket line. It's better than working Coors brew.
I went to a meeting one time where the board of directors were meeting, and here's this Coors up there talking about these, referred to UMAS as the Chicano Mafia, and then women's liberation as braless bitches, and the gay liberation from them goddamn queers, you know, and those blacks. Anyway, he used to say all of this stuff, and I asked this guy, "Who is that?" He said, "That's Joe Coors." I said, "Coors from Coors Brewery?"
There was absolutely no other beer in the nation that could rival Coors' sort of draw to consumers in terms of its mystique and in terms of its identification with sort of the natural beauty and sort of vacation wonderland that the West was being marketed as at that time.
This is Sam Bach, a public historian and exhibit developer for History Colorado who created the recent Beer Here exhibit that traced the history of beer in Colorado. He says Joseph Coors was standing on the back of his brand and using it to push right-wing ideology on a national level.
This was a time when, you know, your choice of beverage signaled your politics. And so in all of this, you know, the racial discrimination and the labor issues, into all this steps Joe Coors, who is in the third generation of Coors men to run this brewery. And Joe Coors had fallen in with the new right, you know, figures embodied by, you know, Goldwater and Reagan, and this sort of neoliberal economic and political group that was running, you know, really the country and our economy at the time, you know, really became this leading figure of the ideology of the new right.
With the success of Cesar Chavez's grape and lettuce boycotts in California, Corky Gonzalez and the Crusade for Justice joined with the GI Forum and National Hispanic Military Veterans Association and took direct aim at Joseph Coors and his beer.
As the boycott continued into the 70s, Freddie saw an opportunity to spread the word on college campuses and do some traveling while he was at it. Here's journalist Juan Espinoza again.
Freddie picked up the banner. He became the chairman of the Aztlan Boycott Coors Committee. And in that capacity, he toured California on a speaking tour, going to campuses there, speaking about the Coors boycott.
Then we decided that we're going to boycott his products at our Boulder campus. So shortly after that, there was a conference in Denver, Chicano Student Conference. I went there and I asked them if they would support our boycott up in Boulder and that all of the campus throughout the state boycott his project, censor him, boycott him. And they said, yeah. So we got a statewide boycott through the universities. We were costing him on the average of $1 million a year in products that were just being sold to the university. Well, later on in life, I used to go speaking at campuses throughout the state, all over the place.
While he was in Sacramento, he went on the radio to talk about the boycott and got a call from the Teamsters Union in San Francisco. They invited him to speak at their meeting the following day.
So I get up there and I do my little spiel about the unions and all that here in Colorado and all that. And there was this guy named Harvey Milk. He was a gay activist.
Harvey Milk was the first openly gay official elected to public office in California after he won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors.
He and Mayor George Moscone were later killed by fellow supervisor Dan White.
Well, I'm there with Harvey Milk, you know. I'm listening to him. And he says, after we're through, he said, I want you to come with me to go down to the gay neighborhood. I said, cool, I could do that, sure. So I went down there, you know, met up with a bunch of people there. They treated me like, you know, treated me with respect and everything. I had a good time. That's when I really first started to learn about the gay movement and the, you know, and I asked Harvey, I says, how do you get the gay businesses to stop buying Coors or selling Coors products? He says, well, he says, I walk in and tell him, if you don't stop selling Coors products, I'm going to beat the shit out of you.
We weren't able to verify this story, but it's an example of the many ways Freddie seemed to find his way backstage for big moments in history.
Among Freddie's most infamous actions against Coors during the boycott was a prank.
One day I was in the UMass office, and I was reading one of those yellow journal of newspapers. And there, see, there says, YAF, Young Americans for Freedom, are presenting Joe Coors Man of the Year Award at the Fifth Mansion in Cherry Creek. And I said, whoa. And then I looked, I said, wow, that's on my birthday, October the 15th. I said, whoa. So I called up UMass in Denver, and I told him, hey, I'm going to throw a party for Freddie the Freak. And we're going to have it at the Fitz Mansion.
Freddie and 80 other Chicano students from UMass showed up outside the Phipps Mansion in one of Denver's most exclusive neighborhoods that night.
One of the things that we had, they'd been given a roundup in Boulder's, what they called the rape whistles. And they're just a regular whistle. And all of us had one. Well, when these cars would pull up in this circular driveway, they'd get off and they'd go through this archway, like a real long, before it got into the main building. Well, every time they'd open the door, like, and we'd all blow our whistles, and you could hear that echo going down. And anyway, so we kept it up. Okay, now here comes Joe Coors and Holly, God bless her, his wife. They're coming up there, and they're walking towards me. And I walk up to him, and I says, God bless you, Joe. He looks at me, smiles, and says, you're fascist. So they walked in, right? One of the neighbors from the community, the neighborhood, come over. I want to call the police. You guys are creating a disturbance and everything. So I said, well, we gather around and say, look, we made our point. We made our point. Why don't we just leave that way? Nobody gets arrested. Oh, in the meantime, we had some bumper stickers that was printed that said, Stop Coors PBS. Coors was running for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting at that time. He was nominated by Reagan. But my kid John and his little buddies were cruising all around that little neighborhood. They're putting bumper stickers on all of these Mercedes-Benz and Cadillacs. And not on the bumper, but on the pink doors.
Juan Espinoza.
It was just one of the many antics that he did that were just really funny. I mean, he was a funny person. That might have been his greatest asset. He was disarming in the sense that sometimes people didn't take him all that serious, but he was serious.
In 1978, Freddie Freak moved to Pueblo, not far from Trinidad, where he'd grown up. His close friends Juan Espinoza and Deborah Espinoza had already moved there.
The three of them decided to settle in Pueblo, following Corky Gonzalez's philosophy that Chicanos who were able to attend university had an obligation to educate and better the Chicano community after graduation.
They also started a community newspaper in Pueblo called La Cucaracha. It was meant to report on parts of the Chicano community that the Pueblo Chieftain and other statewide newspapers didn't cover.
So, but we wrote just mainly things that concerned the poor people, the minorities.
Juan and Deborah did most of the writing, and Freddie helped with layout, printing, and distribution.
They covered issues from access to community health clinics in Pueblo to a dispute over access to the Taylor Ranch at the foot of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains.
The Taylor Ranch dispute was a complicated story about who had the right to own and occupy an enormous parcel of land at the mouth of the San Luis Valley.
Chicano plaintiffs seeking access to the ranch traced their claim all the way back to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
We never made any money. We were always in the red, but it didn't matter because what we were trying to do was we were trying to get the message out.
El Movimiento, under the leadership of Rodolfo, Corky Gonzalez, and others, achieved many things in Colorado and beyond. Things like Chicano studies programs at universities, farmworker rights, and a renaissance in murals and public art projects throughout the Southwest.
It opened doors for politicians like Federico Peña, who became the first Chicano mayor of Denver in 1983, and Ken Salazar, who rose to become Secretary of the Interior under President Barack Obama.
And these achievements belong to the entire movement.
Freddie Freak was just one person, and his impact on the Chicano movement is hard to measure. Deborah and Juan Espinoza say that aside from his role in spreading the word about the Coors boycott, he was often behind the scenes.
Freddie always found a way to make himself useful. He would come into the Cucaracha office when we were doing production weekends. Sometimes he would do a little bit of paste up, but he was mostly just there in case we needed somebody to run an errand. We covered Pueblo very well, but we'd send bundles all over the state to other organizations and other friends and supporters. And Freddie was instrumental in that distribution.
But he was more than just a foot soldier or helper. Freddie was also a self-appointed witness to and keeper of the lore and spirit of the Chicano community, says historian Nikki Gonzalez.
I kind of see Freddie's role as almost this Forrest Gump of the Chicano movement. He was there. He knew these people. He was there to witness the La Cesta Boulder. He was on the campus during the occupation of TB1. And then he was also active in support of La Cucaracha newspaper, which I think is central to the movement. So he popped up in a lot of interesting places. So he's a really good window into the Mexican-American experience.
Freddie's story was more than Freddie's story. His awakening to his own Chicano identity mirrored the awakening of so many others who came together in the movement. And his stories now belong to those who came after him. Here's Jose Ortega, the Exhibits and Collections Coordinator for History Colorado's El Pueblo Museum. Jose grew up in Pueblo around Freddie and his stories.
Always called himself the unofficial archivist of the Chicano movement because wherever Freddie went, Freddie took a tape recorder. Freddie would take video, you know, and this was just things that he knew was important and he knew he wanted to document. And whether it was something was going to come of it later, he didn't know. You know, he just did it because he knew in the moment this was something that needed to be documented and was special.
Along with conducting his oral history, Jose helped Freddie organize his archive of recordings, photographs, newspaper clippings, and memorabilia at the Chicano Movement Archives at CSU Pueblo. Now, Freddie's stories may prove to be among his most important contributions to the movement.
But for Jose, Freddie Freak's most important legacy is the love he found for himself and gave back through the Chicano movement.
Was just somebody who had so much love within himself for his people. That's what drove Freddie to be who Freddie was and to do the things that Freddie did. Chicano to me, in my life, I mean, it means everything to me. It means identity. It means culture. It means pride. Because, you know, like I said, I've been a product of the Chicano movement. I am a product of the Chicano movement. You know, through my education, through my upbringing, through my cultural knowledge, through my history, and, you know, through my family.
Juan Federico Miguel Arguello Trujillo died on May 21st, 2020, of complications from cancer at the age of 81.
Antonio, this is Freddie. I'm just calling you to let you know I got that DVD to work in. It worked out fine. Thank you, bless you, for sending me that. And then, again, thank all of the staff there at El Pueblo for the food they brought me. It is greatly appreciated. You just don't know how much that means to me. I love you guys. God bless you. Bye.
In 1978, Freddie Freak moved to Pueblo, not far from Trinidad, where he'd grown up. His close friends Juan Espinoza and Deborah Espinoza had already moved there.
Lost Highways is a production of History Colorado and History Colorado Studios. It's made possible by a generous grant from the Sturm Family Foundation, with particular thanks to Stephen Sturm and Emily Sturm, and by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to support it, please become a member of History Colorado. You can get 20% off your membership at historycolorado.org/podcast discount. Plus, you get all kinds of great benefits like free admission to our 8 museums around the state, where you can learn more about the stories we tell on Lost Highways, and a subscription to the award-winning Colorado Magazine, which includes access to insightful articles and compelling perspectives on Colorado's past that we've published since 1923.
And even if you don't become a member, you can still get $2 off admission to any of our museums just by mentioning the podcast.
A very, very special thanks to Susan Schulten, our history advisor on this episode, and to Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen.
Thanks to Craig Richardson for production help, and to Amanda Lane of History Colorado, as well as Noah Allen, Charlie Dreyer, and Mel Butler, who recently transcribed all our episodes. And thanks to Lucha Martinez de Luna for background information.
If you'd like to see the transcript of this episode or others, either as a matter of accessibility or because you'd like to use Lost Highways in your classroom, you can find them at historycolorado.org/Lost Highways.
The music for this episode was by Earth Control Pill. Our theme is by Connor Bergal.
Many thanks to our editorial team. Jason Hansen, Sam Bach, Sean Boyd, Brooke Garcia, Steve Grinstead, Kimberly Cronwall, Jose Ortega, Julie Peterson, Angel V. Hill, Marisa Volpe, and Zach Workowicz.
And to our advisory group, which includes Steven Sturm, Emily Sturm, Jason Hansen, Thomas Andrews, Jonathan Futa, Charlie Woolley, Susan Shulton, Tom Romero, and Kara DeGette.
Finally, thanks to the entire staff at History Colorado. I'm Noel Black.
And I'm Tyler Hill. Thanks for listening.